Good morning. As we gather today, we continue a chapel series that works with themes from our common read, the book Between the World and Me. And we are happy to have Professor Kevin Seidel bringing these reflections today. His title is Coates, Hope, and the Bible. What is the connection between Coates, or Between the World and Me, Hope, and the Bible? Kevin Seidel serves as Associate Professor for Language and Literature. A native of California, Seidel came to EMU from the University of Virginia, where he received his PhD in English Literature and was a postdoctoral fellow at the Institute for Advanced Studies and Culture. He is working on a book project that uses original research on the 18th century English Bible to open up new ways of thinking about the history of the English novel. He is also actively involved in scriptural reasoning. That's typically people from Islamic, Jewish, and Christian faith coming together and engaging each other's sacred texts. His teaching and scholarship both explore the changing relationship between religion, secularism, and literature. So Kevin, in a little bit, we'll be happy to hear from you. And first, to open chapel, we have two selections from Emulate Chamber Ensemble. How about if you come on up as I read about you a bit? Emulate is an intimate vocal ensemble of eight singers. There might be eight, maybe nine, specializing in jazz, modern and contemporary concert literature, both secular and sacred. Performances occur not only in chapel about once or twice a semester, but across campus and in the community, and with several touring opportunities, including over spring break. Tomorrow evening, they'll be in Common Grounds Coffee House at 8:30 for an informal concert. The Emulate members also sing with the university choir, and their director is Ryan Keeball. Thank you.
Those lives were mine to love and cherish, to guard and guide along life's way. Oh God, forbid that one should perish, that one alone should go astray. Back in
great glad here. One thing I like about my work as a professor is that I get paid to read good books and talk about them with my students. Even better, I get paid to reread some books, then talk about them again with different students. And I've noticed over the years how often I get books wrong the first time through or catch only part of what's important to the book. This used to worry me. I thought, as a professor of literature, I should be steadily getting so smart and so masterful at reading that I would one day understand every book I read completely the first time through, missing nothing, never again needing to change my mind about anything. But I've given up on that quest. I've learned instead to accept my first readings for what they are, incomplete, partial, only the beginning of a conversation that will continue when I read or hear about that book again. I try to encourage my students to hold on to their first readings, even if they prove wrong, to not be embarrassed by them, so that they can say in their papers how their thinking has changed. It's true that not every book bears rereading. Some aren't even worth finishing. But some books have a way of grabbing you the first time through, attracting your attention, pulling something out of you that you didn't know was there, or filling you with a sense of anticipation that you are on the verge of discovering something about the world that you didn't already know. One of the books that has done this for me over and over again through the years is the Bible. Right, of course. I had to say that. It's chapel, I know. But another book that's done that for me more recently, proven worth rereading, is Ta-Nehisi Coates's Between the World and Me. In fact, it was rereading Coates that sent me back to the Bible to see what it said about hope. Coates is relentlessly critical of what he calls the dream, the American idea that no matter how difficult things may be right now, if we stay positive and hopeful and work hard, happiness is just around the corner. Sound familiar? Coates thinks that this dream of things always just about to get better is a collective delusion, not simply false and unreal, but a dream that perpetuates terrible violence and injustice in our country, against African Americans especially. When we talk about hope today, Coates argues, we are spellbound by the dream. It's hope that enables us to look back at American history and say that slavery, Jim Crow, mass incarceration, police brutality, white racist rallies in Charlottesville, whatever, these are all just temporary setbacks, bumps in the road of American progress. But Coates says, no, slavery isn't a bump in the road. Slavery is the road. There is no America without the enslavement of African Americans. This should be hard for all of us to take in. If you are hopeful about things getting better in America, Harrisonburg, EMU, you're not taking the high, liberal, progressive road. You're on the same old racist highway, paving it again. Well, trying to understand Coates' critique of hope, I thought about how often hope is mentioned in the Bible, always positively, I thought. But a phrase from Romans 4 kept coming to mind, hoping against hope. That word against puzzled me. I knew that Paul was talking about Abram, a scene in Genesis where Abram looks up at the stars and trusts God's promise that God will give him a son. What was Paul catching in this scene? Was Paul reading Abram against certain forms of hope? What did that even mean to set one kind of hope against another? These were the questions I could not have asked without reading Between the World and Me. I missed Coates' criticism of hope completely the first time I read Between the World and Me. So if you're wondering what I'm talking about, even though you read the book, you're not alone. So I read it soon after it came out in summer of 2015. I was in California staying at my sister-in-law's house, babysitting my nephew and son, although babysitting isn't the right word. My nephew was 16 and my son was 15 at the time. The summer before, when they were 15 and 14, when it was just me taking care of these two, no other grown-ups around, my nephew suggested we binge-watch Breaking Bad on Netflix, all 6 seasons. I hesitated for a minute and said, yeah, let's do it. I said it took more than a week of evenings and late, late nights. We played pool and talked about the show between episodes, debated the relative merits of Papa John's versus Domino's. Babysitting, it was more like teenagering, as in they were teenagering me. And I have to say, I loved it. Loved being with those boys like that, watching, talking, eating together, asking them questions, hearing them thinking through the show. The next summer, 2015, we decided to binge watch all of Quentin Tarantino's movies on Netflix. But there were more grown-ups around this time, the various moms, the brother-in-law. None of them wanted to do this with us, and I was feeling a little sheepish about being the bad uncle, dad, college teacher with too much summer time on his hands. So I told the boys, okay, I'll do it, but only if we read and talk about a passage from Aristotle on catharsis. Catharsis? Yeah. It's what tragedies in ancient Greece did for the audience, a collective purging of feelings of envy and fear. Sure, they said. So I found the passage from Aristotle's Poetics online, cut and pasted it into a Word doc, printed out 3 pages, passed around a few pencils, and asked them to mark up the paper as I read the passage aloud. Let me just say that if you think I do this kind of thing at home all the time, like, hey kids, after dinner, how about a little Milton? Believe me, I don't. It almost never happens. That's why I'm telling you the story. Anyway, after talking about Aristotle on catharsis, we watched Reservoir Dogs, played a game of nine ball, talked a little bit about the movie, and after a few more nights like that with Papa John's edging out Domino's, somewhere in the middle of that week of movies, we took a trip down to Southern California to take a campus tour of the University of California at Santa Barbara, where my nephew was interested in going. It was about a 7-hour drive down from the San Francisco Bay Area to Santa Barbara. Between the World and Me had just come out. I knew it was modeled on James Baldwin's letter to his nephew in The Fire Next Time, a book I had just read because I'd heard Coates talk about it a few months before in Charlottesville. He said Baldwin's Fire Next Time made him want to be a writer, and if you've read that beautiful book, you'll know why. Between the World and Me, I knew from pre-publication buzz, was a long letter from Coates to his son about the struggles of being a black man in America. I thought my white boys, my son, and my nephew could learn something from it. I would learn something from it, and not just what it's like to be a black man in America today, but what it's like to be human in America today. They were up for it. Again, they don't always say yes to all my suggestions, but it seems like it this morning in my stories. But they said yes, and we listened to the audio version of the book on the drive down. What do I remember? Fading in and out of attention, listening to Coates read, caught up in the cadence and rhythm of his sentences, a heaviness, a sense that words were not quite sinking in. I already knew that racism was a problem in America. Okay, I get it. I got it by the first chapter. I got it before I read the first page. But where's the hope? Why write this to your son? It wouldn't be until a couple years later when I reread Between the World and Me that I realized by asking, where's the hope, that first time through, by expecting the book to take some positive turn near the end, I wasn't really listening. As many terrible things as there are in the Bible, murder on page 3, a few pages later, the destruction of all living things except Noah, and his family and the animals they carry on board the ark, Abraham's near killing of his son Isaac, Jephthah's straight up killing of his daughter, the atrocities go on, all the way up to, including, and after the crucifixion of Jesus. Despite all this, I was taught to read the Bible as a hopeful book, that I should always feel hopeful while reading it. How did that happen? One of the things I'm grateful for about the Presbyterian church I grew up in, the summer camps I went to, the Young Life groups I was part of in high school, was that it taught me a simple devotion to the Bible, that the Bible was a book where I could discover truth about ultimate reality, that it was a book where I could learn the truth about God. But that basic trust came loaded with a great deal of anxiety about the authority of the Bible. It had to be the perfect, unchanging, absolute, final word on, well, just about everything. In college and in my early 20s, the intellectually bent fellowship groups that I was part of defended the Bible as a repository of absolute truth, the kind of vault of eternal wisdom that could only be cracked by a certain combination of piety, language study, and historical knowledge. The idea was that something unique had been dimly revealed in ancient Israel, then more fully in the life of Jesus, a revelation of God's rules for living that careful exegesis of the text would discover. God's view of sexuality, of science, of politics, all these things were lying close to the surface of the text, waiting for me to discover them. To find them, I had to turn away from the things of the world I lived in, devote myself to Scripture, discover its eternal truths, and then carry those truths with me back out into the world, come what may, no matter how unpopular or unfashionable they seemed. In fact, the more unpopular, the more out of touch with reality, the more likely it was that what I had discovered was from the Lord. A few years ago, I fell into conversation about gender with a pastor I had admired, a pastor who quoted philosophers I like in his sermons, who I assumed, therefore, saw the world the way I did. I told him how angry I was about our church moving so slowly in letting women lead, how it had become so clear to me over time, an embarrassingly long time, that while there may be real God-given differences between men and women, those differences didn't always fall on either side of the leadership line, with women always on one side serving and men on the other leading. Women lead too, I said. They just lead differently. He nodded his head sympathetically, then looked a little sad and stern at the same time, and told me that looking around at the world of business, the world outside the church, yeah, it was totally clear that women were leading. And as much as he admired these women, respected them even as a Christian and as a pastor, he just couldn't affirm what they were doing. That God had created us to occupy certain roles. That God had made Adam first, then Eve. That the Apostle Paul had said women should be silent in the church. Do you want to be part of a church that just ignores those things in the Bible? He paused for dramatic emphasis and said, I wish I could. I could say yes. I wish I could just say yes to egalitarianism, but as a Christian and a pastor who believes in the Bible, I just can't. I could have said, but didn't, what about the fact that in Genesis, the man and woman are both given the mandate to rule over the earth as God's stewards? What about the fact that Paul seems to assume elsewhere that women are prophesying in the church and doesn't have a problem with that? What about the fellow apostle he refers to as Junia, a woman? Who were the first witnesses of the resurrection? But it's not the content of his view that angers me now when I think back about this conversation. It's the ease with which he could dismiss, not even look for, anything else happening in the Bible. It's the way that pastor used the Bible that strikes me now, after reading Coates, the profound turning away from the facts of experience in order to cling to the once upon a time revealed truths of the Bible. If you can accomplish that turning away with a tinge of sadness, a little regret, a little sympathy for the women you're refusing to recognize as leaders, all the better, all the more Christian. When I reread Between the World and Me at the beginning of the semester to get ready to talk about it with my advanced college writing class, I noticed two things that I had missed before. First, a sharp driving criticism of hope, of the dream, and running alongside that critique, a current of love. I am not a cynic, Coates writes to his son. I love you, and I love the world, and I love it more with every inch I discover. How had I missed this? The current of love for his son, his partner, so many other people he profiles and writes about, and for the places he writes about, Howard University, the streets of Paris. Missing this, I largely missed the book. For Coates, the two attitudes of unhopefulness about the future and love for the world are intimately related. It is precisely through his giving up on false hopes that he can know and love the world more deeply. Coates goes after several hopeful visions. One is black nationalism, which he learns to be critical of from his teachers at Howard University, where he thought he would be instructed in the artistic, intellectual, and political glories of the African past. Instead, his teachers show him a past far from perfect. The other is a black politics of respectability, exemplified by his friend Prince Jones and his friend's mother, also the Obama family, who Coates writes about more in his recent collection of essays, We Were 8 Years in Power. Too often, those who believe in the audacity of hope believe that racial problems are best overcome not by dwelling on them, but by overcoming them in the present, living twice as good as white people, even if that means you'll only get half the recognition. But being twice as good did not save Coates' friend Prince Jones. It didn't save Shirley Sherrod, the lifelong advocate of black farmers, from being fired by Obama. But Coates' strongest critique, at least the one that hit me hardest, was his critique of the white American dream. After reading Coates, I thought about how easy it is for me to imagine life for myself happy while others around me suffer. The fact that I'm content with that dream, consider it the best I can do if I achieve my happiness at the expense of others, that internal shrug of the shoulders shows that I have been conscripted into a form of white supremacy. White supremacy? Yeah. This is important to hear. This is something I learned from Coates. White supremacy is not just confined to individuals who harbor ill feelings towards black people. White supremacy is not just a social problem evident in the disproportionate number of black people pulled over on the streets, killed by police officers, kept in prison, or left behind in our schools. It is those things, individual and social. And Coates is right to say that those problems will never go away by talking about them less, pretending that progress will take care of them automatically, eventually. White supremacy is not just about what one hates or the social conditions we passively accept. It structures the way we think about the future. It uses hope not to help us face present reality, but to turn away from it. Okay, thanks to Coates' writing, I'm carrying new questions with me back into my reading of the Bible. And so just four, quickly to end. Where is the Bible critical of hope? After reading Coates, I realized it's critical of hope in a lot of places. So if you read the prophets or the Psalms, you'll hear all of them talking about putting your trust in chariots, in foreign powers, in kings. Right? So there is this sort of thread of criticism of hope running throughout the Bible. In Isaiah 50, there's this fantastic passage where Isaiah calls out all these false prophets for carrying these torches of insight and illumination. And he says, I hope you burn yourself on the torches. Who's going to follow me into the dark where we don't know the way? And he says that that's the way to follow God. The second question, how much of my disappointment with Bible reading has been shaped by my sort of entanglement with white supremacy? In other words, if I've learned to read the world in a certain way by ignoring and overlooking injustice and suffering in order to hold on to hope, how much of that attitude do I carry back into my reading of Scripture so that I don't see the suffering that's depicted in Scripture? I don't really pay attention to the scenes of injustice. I gloss over them. And so I can cling to a kind of paltry, anemic hope. Right? So that there's, after reading Coates, I'm starting to sort of pay attention more to the way I'm trained to sort of read the world in a shallow, hopeful way, how that affects the way I then go to the Bible and read it similarly. So there's a kind of unholy resonance between a white supremacist way of reading the world and my own Christian way of reading the Bible. Okay, a third question. What was Abraham thinking and feeling when God took him outside to look at the stars? I got to that question by reading Coates talk about hope, and I had that phrase, hoping against hope, rattling in my head, that word against, and that's from Romans 4, where Paul is talking about this moment in Abram's life where God comes to him and promises him a son. And in that moment, Abraham trusts God for provision in a way that Paul wants to sort of hold on to and say is exemplary for us as Christians. Right? And I think what's going on with Paul in Romans 4 is something like in that moment, Abram understood that God wasn't just giving him a human son to connect, to have a sort of a tribal lineage. He was giving him a vision of this larger humanity that he could be part of by trusting in God. And it's that movement from tribal concern for your own kids to this larger concern for all of humanity represented by all these stars, I think that Paul finds really intriguing. And he says that's an anticipation of sort of Christian hope and trust. And so I think that's where he gets this phrase, hoping against hope, right? So Abram goes into the scene with a small hope of having kids, right? But then God sort of works against that in some ways to lift him up to hoping for this larger humanity. But if you go back and read that scene in Genesis 15, you realize there's a lot more going on there than Paul talks about in Romans 4. And so when I read that now, one of the things I notice is that Abram is in a really terrible spot in Genesis 15 when that story opens up. He has just gone to war with a local king to rescue his nephew Lot. And when he does that, he gets involved in these internecine tribal battles that are happening. And he has this other king, the king of Sodom, come to him and say, hey, thanks for killing that other, or sort of taking down that other king. you can take whatever bounty you want from the loot. And Abram says, look, I'm not taking anything from you because I don't want you to say you made Abram rich. So in that moment, Abram has just angered, right, the king he's destroyed to get his nephew, and the king he was in alliance with, and he's in this incredibly risky, vulnerable place. The promise to that he would have sons is like long distant. And Genesis 15 opens up, and God says, Abram, do not be afraid, right? I am your shield and your reward. And I think that the reason God says Abram should not be afraid is because Abram is afraid. And the reason he says, I will be your reward, is because Abram is worried about rewards and like how he's going to take care of his people. And so I think it's fascinating that it's in this moment of deep fear and uncertainty that God meets Abram, that Abram encounters God, right, in this moment of insecurity. And God doesn't just say, like, I'm going to give you a family. I am going to do that. But I'm going to do this in a way that reminds you of your connection to all these families sort of all over the earth. Something like that, I think, is happening in Genesis 15. So after reading Coates, I just sort of want to go back and think about this question more, about what's going on in that passage. So the last question I'm asking, what will I tell my nephew, my son, my daughter, you, my students, my colleagues, right, about these things? So after reading Coates, I think a question I have that I'm taking back to the Bible is how far the quality of our love for our friends, for the world, depends on the depth with which we have faced injustice in the world and talked about our own suffering. In other words, before reading Coates, I thought having love for others depended on blocking out the suffering and injustice of the world. Right? But after reading Coates, and after sort of looking at Scripture again, I think I have this new hopefulness that it's through are facing injustice, looking at suffering, talking about it with others, connecting with others through our suffering, doing that will actually increase our love for one another and for the world. Right? So that's the example I think I learned from Coates, and the question I'm taking with me to see if that's in Scripture too. Thanks.
Thank you, Kevin. And if you haven't read Between the World and Me yet, I encourage you to do so, maybe over Christmas break, and read it as Kevin is challenging himself and maybe us alongside the Bible and other texts and ponder these things. Go in peace. A little bit disturbed, though.